going deep within your own heart and your soul. Feel there the universal Christ consciousness, that which was born 2,000 years ago, was with the creation from the very beginning, its very foundation. It's been within you since time immemorial. It is with you now. And when you open your heart, when you open your mind, when you open your soul and receive those divine emanations, the radiance shining within your own soul, bringing you a great sense of peace and joy and love and all the divine virtues. Feel that that's emanating in you and broadcasting from you out to this entire world. See that radiance of love and light, joy and peace, spreading out all over this world, touching the hearts and minds of everyone, raising the vibration of this world, easing those who are in strife and conflict and bringing them peace, being a healing balm to those who are in pain and hurting, bringing them love, penetrating into the depths of darkness of those who have depression, a tamasic mood, bringing them light. It is the panacea for all the human ills and woes. And see this world being lifted up into a higher vibration, where light is going throughout everything and everyone. There's a feeling of universal brotherhood. And a knowledge of a union with their Creator. A world in which all are seeking to harmonize their lives with the highest vibration. Send that out from this broadcasting station within you and bless this world. Help to lift it up and help to transform it. I thought I would read to you from a letter. We were bequeathed many letters from Mother and Father Hamilton to Herwin Lutz, who was Mother's first disciple in the early 1950s. Mother had traveled to Anandashram. Herwin was in the army at that time, stationed in Germany. And so there's a correspondence, and eventually Herwin had leave and was able to come to Anandashram himself. This is written to Herwin and also to the meditation group in Seattle. So it's to the spiritual community. Dearly beloved, it doesn't seem possible that 2 weeks have elapsed since my last letter to you, but we seem to be living in a dream world here, and time has ceased to exist. We continue to take as many notes as possible and shall have many interesting things to tell you as time permits. In the meantime, I shall continue my narrative. We had to make a couple of stops in town on our way to the air freight office, which is located at the Tacoma Airport. So when we finally got there, it was 5:00. Father took the two cartons inside for weighing and handling, while I waited and waited and waited in the car. A little later, he came out, and with a rather wild look in his eyes, "Do you have to take all of those books with you? It's going to cost $189 to ship those two small packages." I told him we had to take them, so with a muttered prayer, he disappeared into the office again. After a while, a young fellow with an equally wild look in his eyes came striding out of the office and remarked to two others who were standing on the loading dock, "My God, that guy's crazy." Knowing Father's penchant for getting to the bottom of things, I could just imagine what was happening. Finally, after an hour's wait, he emerged flush but triumphant. By going over the various schedules and routes with them step by step, he had helped them to figure out a means whereby he could save himself $72. They are probably still wondering what happened to them. What an organizer. 6:15 p.m., we were off at last, knowing that, exhausted as we were, we would have to push every mile of the way if we were going to make our plane on time. The only trouble was that the terrific uproar at home, we hadn't even had breakfast, and so we decided to stop at a drive-in and have something to eat. We sat and laughed because it seemed, at the rate we were going, as though the plane would probably take off before we got to Tacoma. We tried hard, but we couldn't think of anything else to delay us, so we got in the car again and started out. This time, we drove steadily until we got to Vancouver. We wanted to get a traveler's check cashed, so we decided that probably a restaurant would be the most likely place at that time of night. We found one that was open, and we decided if we ordered something to eat, they might cash our check with better grace. Our efforts were of no avail. They had never heard of anything but an American Express traveler's check, and ours was Cook's, so they refused to cash it. Luckily, Father had just enough change left to pay the bill, or we might have ended our already over-eventful day by washing dishes. We were now out of money and practically out of gas. We had gasoline credit cards with us, but because we were leaving the country for a year, we wanted to stay strictly on a cash basis. We drove over the bridge to Portland and stopped at the first station, which was open. We had our tank filled, made out a traveler's check, and the boy cashed it without a murmur. Maybe he didn't know the difference. We heaved a sigh of relief because we now had money for a motel and could sleep for a few hours. We were at the point where we were much too tired to go on, but we knew we had to. Finally, when we arrived at Oak Ridge about 2:30 a.m., we could go no further, and we routed a motel manager out of sound sleep, took the first room he showed us, and literally fell into bed. It seemed as though we hadn't closed our eyes when the alarm went off at 6 a.m. We groaned and thought, "Oh, no." But we had no choice, so we struggled into our clothes and prayed that we'd be able to keep awake on the road. It was a lovely day, warm and sunny. Some of the leaves had started to turn color, and the trees looked like they had discarded their summer garments for the more brilliantly bedecked ones of autumn. As we rolled along, we feasted our eyes on the beautiful scenery, trying because we knew that we wouldn't be seeing again for a long time, to remember every little detail. We stopped at Shasta for lunch, and then I took my turn driving. I had been pushing right along, making excellent time while Father alternately dozed and read, when all of a sudden he came to notice that I was doing 70 miles an hour, so I got severely reprimanded. I tried to slow down to 65 miles an hour, but nothing happened. Father spoke to me again. I tried again, and with the same result. Finally, I told him I guess it was because I was getting old and my foot was just too heavy on the throttle. After giving me a long discourse on driving and speed laws, he finally gave up. But guess who got stopped just before we reached Corning and fined for doing 70 miles an hour? We were that surprised when we heard a siren and the highway patrolman signaled us to pull over. We wondered what in the world he wanted because we knew we couldn't have been speeding, not with Father driving. He put on his deepest air of puzzled humility, stepped out of the car, and asked the patrolman what was wrong. The patrolman told him and started writing out a ticket. Father explained to him in his most persuasive manner that we were in a terrible hurry because we had to be in San Francisco to catch a plane for Hawaii, that we were ministers, that our ultimate destination was India, where we planned to stay for a year, etc., etc., hoping that he would relent and tear up the ticket. He was very friendly and very interested in our plans, particularly about India, because it seems his sister and brother-in-law were both missionaries and had spent time there, and he literally spouted information while he continued to write out the ticket. Finally, in desperation, Father said, "I don't quite know what to do about this ticket. It's just 6 o'clock now, and the station will be closed, and I won't be here to take care of it." The officer looked at his watch and said the station in Corning was open until 6:15, so if we hurried, we could just make it. Being honest, we made it and started out again with $15 less in our travel fund. We had a good laugh over the whole thing and chalked it up as one of the highlights to be remembered in our great adventure. Although we had been carefully sorting and sifting for weeks in an effort to keep the weight of our luggage down to 44 pounds each of us was allowed, we packed and left in such a hurry that we had no idea of what the final outcome was. It really took some figuring to include in 88 pounds everything we would need on our trip, plus our needs for a year's stay in India. We both had a very uncomfortable feeling that the things we had thankfully remembered to stuff in at the last minute, because we knew we couldn't possibly get along without them, had increased the weight to something slightly more than the minimum. When we stopped at the Nut Tree just outside of Sacramento for dinner, we asked one of the waitresses if there was any scales available in the place. She said the manager had a set of bathroom scales, so armed with paper and pencil and scales, Father went to the car to weigh each piece of luggage separately. We found out to our horror that we were 40 pounds over the 88 allowed between us. At $9 per pound for excess luggage, we had to make a choice of unloading half of what we had with us or stay home ourselves. It was quite a predicament, but to be in but full course, there was one thing we could do. Then I am going to skip ahead. The alarm rang at 6, and completely benumbed state, we had breakfast, gathered ourselves for our luggage together, and started for the airport. Ed had taken the morning off to be with us, and Ace Pearson, bless him, having come all the way from Alameda to see us off, was waiting for us at the airport. Also, much to our surprise and pleasure, Joe and Ann Forbush and Bill and Min Klum came down to say goodbye. It was a real wrench to bid farewell to all of our good friends and our family, and to see the shores of the America fading into the distance as our plane winged its way over San Francisco Bay. As though symbolic of our purpose of our journey, the last object which stood out before our vision was a huge white cross outlined against the sky. Our very best wishes for a Merry Christmas. It is our prayer that this holy season you may dive deep into the ocean of Christ consciousness and find there the priceless pearl of God realization, which alone has the power to bring peace on earth, goodwill toward all men. And I wanted to continue here with Mother's letter to Herwin, my beloved son. I'm sorry for not having answered your letter sooner, but in addition to the uproar and commotion caused by Swami Anandasram's visit last week, Father and I have been ill. The weather really knocks us for a loop. The constant humidity is so enervating that we have much trouble with the constantly spiced food, that we have both lost a lot of weight. Father was desperately ill Sunday. He vomited profusely, ran an extremely high temperature, and was delirious. We had the doctor, but his efforts were of no avail. Finally, he got so bad that we had to call Mother Krishnabai and Papa. Papa came and rubbed his hand all over Father's stomach and his head, and within 10 minutes, the fever left and quieted down and went to sleep. However, the next day, Papa was sick in bed all day. Apparently, he had taken Father's condition into his own body and worked it out. The way of saints are mysterious, but wonderful. We are having some terrific experiences in our quest for complete God realization, and believe me, some are not easy to take. It takes more than a great desire to realize him. One must renounce inwardly, as well as outwardly, all forms of attachment and surrender oneself entirely to God. We must love him beyond and above all else without even the desire for the reward of himself. Only then does he come to us. Only then do we attain the highest form of realization. We become so impatient, but unless the body and mind are conditioned to receive the tremendous power of his light, when that state is finally attained, our whole beings would burn with the fire of 1,000 deaths. So add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindliness, and to brotherly kindliness charity. For these things lie in you and abound. They make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that was a quote from Peter 1:7-8. I was reading over your letter of October 20th and your comment about Merton's Seeds of Contemplation. There is always a cause for the so-called evil in man. But if we look to our own lives, can we not see that that which appeared as evil to us and caused us suffering was the very thing which purified us and brought us God consciousness? If we want to truly love another, we can do only when we know that we are not different from him, and he is but another body of ours. The immortal self within us has assumed innumerable forms. So we have to see the whole universe as an expression of the self with a capital S. Then only our love flows out in floods to all beings and creatures in the world equally. Only then we attain self-realization in the universal vision of God. God has placed you where you are so that you may learn to see him there. Why don't you write on the bare space on the back of the envelopes like I do? Bless you, my little one. Love, Mother. I thought you would enjoy hearing some of these experiences. And mundane as they are, aren't they human? Aren't they what we all go through in life? And this quest for God, this quest for realization, is filled with the things of the mundane. When we read the life of Jesus, we see that he lived a human life, particularly if we fill out some of the pages. It's in retrospect that man made Jesus a God. But when you read the pages, the people that Jesus healed, the different ones that he interacted with, he didn't demand that they kneel down and bow to him or pray to him or even accept him as the sole means for finding God. He would say, sin no more. Go out and lead a good life. Don't be a hypocrite. And so on. He exhorted them to good behavior, to godly behavior, because that is the foundation and the means from which we launch ourselves into the higher realms of realization. Some people think that they can attain God realization and not tell the truth, not steal, and so on. But this is just absolutely not true. Mother Krishna Bhai would at times tell people at the ashram, you are not even learning the ABCs. How can you then expect to go on to higher experiences? So we lead a good life. We learn to tell the truth only. We take one virtue. This is something that we went over at Loon Lake this last time, is that we took one virtue, and it led to all the other virtues. One good virtue leads to another. Because you can't tell the truth always and not have compassion, not be kind. There is something endemic within it that when we pick up one thing that we really go to work on, it'll touch every aspect of our life. This notion of telling the truth always, it's not an easy thing to do. And it doesn't mean that we need to go out and tell everybody everything about ourselves. But we take a vow within ourselves that we will never speak an untruth. We will never speak an untruth. So that everything that we say will be an expression of truth. How in the world do we think that we can realize truth and not tell the truth? So this is an example of taking one virtue and how it leads to all the others, because you can't always be telling the truth and not be connecting with every other good virtue. This is all a mental, individual will form of attuning ourselves to higher consciousness. But it is not higher consciousness alone. And many of the traditional religions leave it right there. You just try to lead a good life, and when you leave this body, then you'll get your reward, then you'll know the truth, then you'll realize God. But here, you live in ignorance. But this is not what Jesus taught. Jesus taught, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these other things shall be added unto you." The kingdom of God is within you. The kingdom of God is here. It is now. It has come. Now, it didn't just come when he was saying it or when John the Baptist was saying it. It's always been here. It's always been a part of you. But it is like a diamond that is buried deep into the ground. And there is all kinds of mud and refuse that lies on top of it. And in order to get at it, we have to begin to remove the mud of ignorance, the veil of wrong behavior, of wrong perceptions. We have to really go to work on ourselves. It's not just something that will come to us automatically. It is, as Mother said, the pearl of great price. She told the story of a man who had the most perfect pearl in the entire world. And this is many, many years ago, and he asked for the astounding sum at that time of $1,000 for this pearl. And so many people came, and they made one kind of offer after another. He didn't accept any of them, and a man came, and he offered him $500 for this pearl. The man said, "No, don't even bother." The man said, "All right, $750. No, only $1,000. The man said, "All right, I'll give you $999. He's testing him. "Will you just take $999? Surely that's fair." "No, only $1,000. And this is the pearl of great price, and it is the pearl of God realization inside of us. As long as we hang on to anything and call it our own, then we will not have that pearl of great price. We will not have paid the full price for that pearl. As long as we hang on to any desire nature, as long as we hang on to any hurt, any desire for revenge, anything at all that we call our own, it will not allow us to have that full and complete realization. This is what it means to go the way of the cross and the Christ. Because Jesus surrendered it all, it is so poignant that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was praying, asking the disciples to stay awake with him, but they were constantly falling asleep. And he was in real distress. This was a conundrum. He didn't want to go this way. He wanted to be able to, if at all possible, to let this cup pass from me. And so he was negotiating with God. And he was asking that it be just something a little bit less than what he knew he was going to have to go through. Now, in the human story, he was going to go through a trial. He was going to be tortured and humiliated and finally killed very cruelly upon a wooden cross. But this is all symbology for what goes on within us, that this body is the cross. It says in the Bible that the cross bled and that the cross suffered. Well, a wooden cross doesn't bleed. A wooden cross does not suffer. What this cross refers to is this human body. And when you stand upright with your feet together and your arms outstretched, you're in the form of a cross. And when you are arising in the spine through this powerful kundalini force within the spine, it rises up through the spine and meets here at the heart center. That's where your arms are held outstretched. And this is the first stage of the mystical crucifixion. And it is here that the sepulcher, the stone, is within your own heart. And the stone is there, and you don't feel universal love, divine love for one and all. If somebody's nice to you, if they treat you the way you like them, then you give them love. If they don't, then maybe you get angry with them, you don't love them anymore. This is human love, and it has scales on it. It has one side is all the pluses, and on the other side is all the negatives. And if the negatives outweigh the pluses, you might just write that person off. Divine love is different than that. Divine love flows through you. It comes from a source higher than you, and that as you give, so shall you receive. You let that love flow freely and purely out to all the world. Now, this is something that human love simply does not have the capacity to do. But when you feel God's love flowing through you, it's not a respecter of persons. It will flow out to a rock, to a tree, to a flower, to a baby, to an older person, to any individual, to your enemy. It doesn't make any difference. It just flows. And if you stop it from flowing, if you put a rock on that sepulcher and stop the heart from flowing, then you deny yourself, because your pleasure comes from it moving through you, and you're the first receiver of that love. You stop that love, and you stop receiving it. And you may think all kinds of reasons from a human perspective. Well, this person was cruel. They didn't treat me right, or they didn't treat somebody else right, so I shouldn't love them. They don't deserve this love. But the fact is, we all deserve that love. And it is that love that will help to purify us. I think all of us have had mentors in our life when they have perhaps seen us in a better light than we see ourselves. I remember a fellow, he was Gene Simmons. He owned a company, and when I worked as a young man, 14, 15 years old, I worked for my father, and I would go over and I would load turnips and rutabagas that Gene Simmons had in his warehouse. And sometime during the conversation, I really felt a great love for this man. And at some point, he'd say, "You're a scholar and a gentleman." Well, it's just something that he said, but it was something in the way that he said it. And I just stood up a little straighter and felt a little taller. I wanted to live up to this. It's kind of a small, silly thing. But it's the way that I felt at the time. And we've all had mentors that have seen us in a better light than we see ourselves. And it's wanted us to rise up. It's wanted us to be better. Now, it's not that we always did it and we did it perfectly. I was a little scoundrel at other times, and I didn't live up to that. But it was a seed that was sown inside of me. When we come into the province of saints and realize masters, they see us better than we see ourselves, because they see God in us. They see the innate divinity within us. And that helps to lift us up. Jesus said, "And if I be lifted up, shall lift up this whole world with me." Now, we look around at the world today and we see it's not all living as Jesus lived. It's not all living in Christ consciousness. So was he lying, or was he telling the truth? And he was telling the truth, because as he was lifted up and went through this transformation, went through the life of the Christ and the cross, he did lift up this world, and he continues to lift up this world. And so it is with everyone who rises up in consciousness. You do not live a life of isolation. You could still be living in a cave and isolated in that way, and you would still have an effect on this world. One of the most beautiful experiences is when I was standing near Babaji's cave on the rooftop of an ashram there. And I was standing there, and it was a beautiful moonlit night, an absolutely full moon, up in the Himalayas, so the skies were so clear, the stars were so bright, and there was two planets perfectly positioned on either side of the moon that it made me think those are the two human eyes and the moon is this beautiful ajna. So I was thinking in this poetic form, and it was 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd been up meditating on the rooftop. And suddenly I felt a gust of wind, only it wasn't a gust of wind. It was a gust of grace. It was a gust of divine energy that moved down by me, and it just came and it passed by me and it went down through this valley out to the world. And that was followed by another gust of spiritual purity, spiritual energy, and then another and another. And I knew with deep within me that there were meditating yogis up in these mountains, and that as they were divinely communing within themselves, they were sending out this grace, and it flowed out like one wave after another. So you could live in total isolation, and you would still have an uplifting effect upon this world. This is a tremendous thing. When you sit in your room, and you sit in your chair, and you go deep within yourself, and you feel the presence of God, that presence goes out into your home, it goes out into your community, and the more deeply and the more powerfully you commune with your Lord, the more powerful, the more uplifting becomes that vibration that goes out from you. It was interesting, there was a group who wanted to do an experiment with meditation. And so they rented a space in a warehouse district. Now this area was known as a high crime area. And once a week they came and they meditated for 1 hour in this loft. And they did this for some months. And then they asked for and got the police records for that area, and violent crime went down during that 3-month period just for 1 hour. This group, I don't know how many, but I don't think it was a large group, just this group got together and meditated for that 1 hour. Isn't that interesting? What kind of an effect can we have on this world? And not just one or two, but if dozens, hundreds, thousands all start to deeply feel the presence of divine consciousness, that love, that light, that uplifting current, what effect would that have on this world? And if those thousands turned into millions? Instead of all the things that we see on the tabloids today, could it be that having spiritual experience, aspiring for a better life, how much did you give? How much did you do for this world? How did you serve it? Those became the headlines. Those became the subject of talk shows. And people felt inspired by that. They wanted to live up to a higher light, to a higher level, and everyone striving to do the same thing. Imagine a world in such a way, and how this world would change. We have absolutely everything that we need for everyone to have enough to eat, to have shelter, to have clothes, to have education. It's all here. It's all here. There's that most interesting story of the man who died and went to heaven. Excuse me, first he went to hell. And in hell, he saw there a large banquet table with all of this food spread out all over it. Then he saw a curious thing. On the ends of everyone's hands was a long utensil, a fork, that was made in such a way that the person couldn't pick up food from their own plate and feed themselves. And so being in hell, he saw all of these people, they were fighting, they were scrapping, trying to get some kind of food, they were all starving. And he thought that was very interesting, and then suddenly he's transported up into heaven. He saw exactly the same thing in that there is a large banquet table, a lot of food on the table, and the same curious thing was true for the people there, that they had these long utensils attached to the end of their hands to the point where they could not feed themselves. But the difference was everybody was happy, everybody was laughing, everybody was smiling because they were feeding each other and reaching across the table and giving it to their neighbor. These are not difficult concepts. It's not even that hard to live up to. And if we can begin to see this world becoming just such a place, that it places in this world that are currently hells could be transformed into heavens, heaven on earth at least. That people who live in a field of separation, they live in darkness, they live in fear, they live in depression, that they put their minds upon the star is seen here at the point between the eyebrows, and that is the star within you. The Ida and the Pingala are these two twin forces that come up between the spine and joins the spine here at the Ajna and produces this most brilliant light. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it comes as this five-pointed star. And deep within your brain are the two glands that produce those substances that are representative of Joseph and Mary, and they come together and they form a Christ seed. And that Christ seed travels down the ganglionic nervous system and is deposited into a cave-like area behind your stomach. And Bethlehem means house of bread. It's your stomach. You see, all of this happens right within you. And so then the passions rise up. Herod represents the passions, and he wants to kill all the children. He wants to expel this Christ seed out through sex activity. But in this particular instance, you withhold that, and the Herod passions die. They subside down. And then the seed continues on down to the base of the spine, and that's Egypt. And then it makes its way up through the spine. And Galilee means the circuit, and so it comes up through the circuit of the spine, and it gathers the disciples, and the disciples are these energy centers on either side of the spine, positive and negative. Excuse me. And so this Christ seed is gathering up the disciples and drawing it up the spine, finally coming up to the heart center, where, as we said, begins the mystical crucifixion. And when that represents the physical world, and then you go up, and it's 3 days that Jesus resided in this mystical crucifixion and in this cave. And then you rise up to the throat center. That's the second day. And the third day is going up into the Christ center, up into the head, and the Ajna. And even there, we have a thin veil of separation between Christ consciousness, I and my Father are one. You have this feeling of oneness with the infinite Father, and yet you still retain this sense of I-ness. And finally, that bubble of I-ness dissolves, and you merge into the complete absolute consciousness of the universal vision. And if it is divine will, and your will and divine will are not different now, and you are meant to come back into this body then you come back into this body and you serve. There are some realize, masters, that I have fulfilled what I have come for, and they just simply drop the body when they have developed to that point. This is a tremendous story. It's a blueprint that is laid out in these scriptures of what every person goes through from the human to the divine. Isn't that fantastic? And it's all embedded in these stories. Now, Jesus himself said, to you it is given the truth, to others in parable form only. And why is this? Because people who have not developed their consciousness to the point where they can comprehend the parables are not ready for them. So they derive truth in the way that they best see it. If somebody is a bit of salt of the earth, a basically good person, they go to church, they hear the stories, they strive to be a better person. They strive to tell the truth. They strive to be honest. They strive to all of those things. They are making their own best spiritual progress right where they are. And they're not ready for the higher path, for the inner path, and that's all right. We've all been there. But as the soul gradually works on themselves and refines their own consciousness, suddenly they are no longer satisfied with the fables, with the stories that they've been given and the interpretation for which they've been given it. They know that there must be more. They may not know what that is, but they know that there's more to it. And now they're open to the inner teachings, to the higher teachings, and they have refined themselves to the point where they're now able to proceed that way. So we should not look at somebody else and think badly of them because perhaps they're following a more traditional, orthodox way. That may be exactly what's right for them. And as long as they're making soul progress where they're at, that's fine. That's fine. And when they get restless and they want something more than that, they'll be brought to a teacher who can unfold that for them and put them onto that higher path. So this is a wonderful creation that we see. And it's all evolving back toward the divine consciousness. And you can ask, well, why the play in the first place? Why is there a veil of separation? Why do we go through all of these experiences? And the answer, whether it's satisfying or not, is that this is God's play. This is His Leela. And we say, well, I didn't ask for this. Why am I being subject to this? But the truth is, on some level, we did ask for this. We desire to be here. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. This is all a product of individual desire. And it's individualized aspects of God. We wanted to experience this play. We wanted to experience this field of separation. But knowing that when we were ready, this birth of the Christ could happen within us. We would turn. It's not an easy thing because we have to expend as much energy into desiring, rising above all the snares of Maya, of this duality that we have put into it in getting ourselves into this mess in the first place. But when we're willing with all of our heart, mind, strength, and soul to surrender it all to the divine being and turning it all over to God and asking Him to lift us up, then grace enters in. This intelligence, this power from on high comes into us, and this is the birth of the Christ seed within us. The second coming of Christ, people are looking to the skies up in the heavens, waiting for Jesus to return. They've been waiting for how many thousands of years? And they're waiting for that return and expecting Jesus to take care of business. He'll kick out the evildoers and create 1,000 years of peace. But this is something that happens within you. And it comes within you. And the 1,000 years of peace is the 1,000-petal lotus that is talked about in the Hindu scriptures. It's different symbols for the same experience. And when you rise up into the highest consciousness, you feel this tremendous power tingling and reverberating and unfolding within your own brain. And you feel it as 1,000 petals, all vibrating, all alive, all filled with light. And you rise up above this body. You may be vaguely aware of having an outline of a body, but what you're mostly aware of is this absolute divine consciousness. And it radiates out from this crown chakra of 1,000 petals, 1,000 years, and it radiates out such peace, a peace beyond understanding, beyond anything that we could create. It's not just the cessation of wars, conflicts, and fights. It is a peace that is profoundly moving. And the thing is that we feel that we are finally arriving at home. Ah, this is what my heart has been desiring all these many years. It came in so many different forms. I thought it would be through a profession. I thought it would be through a marriage. I thought it would be through children and all of these things. And individually, all of those things are good things. But that ultimately, It is this tremendous Christ experience, by whatever name you wish to call him. As Shakespeare said so eloquently, a rose is still a rose, by whatever name you call that rose. God is God. Nirvana, God. It doesn't make any difference. Krishna, Ram. It's just the name, but the experience is universal. The experience is universal. So let us take advantage of this season as we come into the winter solstice. There's a powerful vibration that goes out. It's a time of change. And it's a time to go deep within and discover that light, that life, that love, that joy, and to let it radiate from us and to be a blessing to this world. If you'll please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet and surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. I bow to the light within you. And let us sit just for a few minutes, opening ourselves to that divine consciousness. And the thing is, we can't prescribe how it will come to us. It may come as just a whisper of a peace, just like a delicate breeze over the petals of a flower. Or it may come to us as a tremendous storm, or anything in between. But let us open our antenna of attention, of sensitivity. Feel those Christ-like vibrations and allowing them to lift you up